rapt with attention here to hear us talk. And my name is Petter Jothen. I teach religion at St. Olaf College, and I am going to talk a little bit about consumption this week. And each session is designed to be sort of independent, so you don't have to come to tomorrow's if you don't want to. And they're more thematic, if it interests you. We are consumptive creatures. We are here at Holden because we are consumptive creatures. Holden itself was a mine complex that took things out of the earth so that we could have cars and wires and chips and everything that sort of makes our normal life possible. And one of the things I'm hoping to sort of think about this week is sort of what drives consumption. It's not just that we want things, but I'm sort of operating under the assumption that there's something inside of us or something that God gave us that drives our consumption. And it's obvious that we need things. You know, we need food, we need shelter, we need clothes, we need relationships. So part of it is that, but we live in a society that is so full of things. Ironically, for many of us who are Christians, you know, we have big houses and big cars, and the big TVs that we have lots of channels. So there's lots of different avenues that we're consuming, lots of restaurants, things of that nature. And so my hope this week is just to sort of think with all of you about what it yet means to be a Christian amidst this type of context. So today, for instance, we're going to talk about corporate branding and relate it specifically to self-interest. And a part of why I'm doing that is because ultimately I think so much of our consumption has to do with this restlessness that we have inside of us. And so the way I want to begin is with this quote. And today we're going to have some quotes, we're going to talk about them, I'm going to throw up some more quotes from people and maybe a little bit of analysis. But I want this to be an active forum for us, an active conversation. Because we are all sort of faced with decisions every day about how we consume. We're faced with decisions here at Holden about how to consume. I mean, there's a bookstore, and the bookstore is full of stuff. And frankly, that stuff has a brand on it too, not only who made it, but the fact that it says Holden on it. That you wear it outside of this village and people go, hey, I know about Holden. So branding is more than just corporate. In fact, I think Holden has a brand. I actually was hoping to find a picture, but the internet was down every time I tried to use it to pull up a picture. So I want to start here. And I was hoping, first off, if someone could read this for us. Any volunteers?
All right.
Great.
You have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they rest in you.
And I'm hoping some of you recognize the quote. It's one of the more famous quotes from Augustine. But what resonates in the quote? Any thoughts initially? I know it's a broad question, but I want to start there.
Restlessness resonates with me.
Say more.
Well, there are a lot of things I want that I don't have. And so I understand my life in a significant way in relationship to those desires or hopes, aspirations. There are different levels, different kinds, but I don't think my main mode of being is just being at one with what I have.
Sure.
And how things are.
Sure. So there's a complexity. A, the types of desire, type of restlessness. It's not just that you're restless for God, you're restless for things. So, other thoughts when you see this quote?
I never know if I actually, see, here's the thing. I never know if I want to actually stop being restless. I've thought about this a lot, and I've come to realize it's not like a goal of mine anymore. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like it should be. Like, I should want to be really zen.
Okay.
You're
that's great.
That's great.
You're
a better person.
That's
yeah,
great, yeah.
Yeah. And I come to realize that I don't want to be that. It's just really not who I am, and so I don't know, but I always feel sort of bad about that. Like, that's how I should feel. So I just want to throw that out there.
And of course, that's a particular type of restlessness. I mean, you want to be a good person, and you're restless until you're a good person. Is that what I heard, or not?
No. I think no.
No.
I feel like not. Well, maybe I'm misunderstanding. I feel that being restless is sort of a bad thing, and that I should want to be restful, but I don't want to be restful. You know, whether it's about experience or things or whatever it is, you know, not necessarily things, but whatever.
Yeah, I think I remember reading something by Jurgen Moltmann who sort of challenged this quote in that way, basically saying that when we do, ironically, when we do find rest in God, we become more restless, is what he was basically saying, that God makes you, he was saying that he was disagreeing, saying God actually makes you restless.
Maybe, yeah, I wonder if it means like in a different way.
Righteous indignation, probably.
Okay. So there's a good critique, I think that's a healthy critique. Other thoughts? Surprised no one brought that up too.
Are we branded in some way by God in our making and manufacturing?
That's a great question. I mean, Augustine certainly thinks
that. Isn't that what the mark is at that business? The brand?
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about that.
Doesn't it make God the ultimate consumer?
Or the corporate interest?
Yeah. That's right.
Ultimate corporate interest.
Single payer system.
Yeah.
I wanted to start here because I do think it ties those things well together well. On the one hand, you have made us for yourself. God has made us a certain way. And in some ways, we live in a world that makes us restless because we are not with God. And I think in many ways, the reality is that this restlessness manifests itself in a lot of different ways. A spiritual restlessness. Yes, I'm searching for God no matter what I do. A restlessness in trying to sort of feel the anxiety that you have about not finding the peace that God offers. And if you know, Augustine's ultimate point is that really what we have to do is find God in our world here. And by doing so, we find the peace that God offers. He's sort of more optimistic. Actually, much more optimistic than someone like Martin Luther. It feels like you can never actually get to the point and find that peace. Every day is sort of the daily struggle of trying to be peaceful. But my hope is at least that we start here because this idea of A, God made us, and that we ultimately have our end and beginning in God, but that we are restless until we are with God. And that in this life of ours, we are never at peace. And because we are never at peace, we try and fill it. Some ways are good ways to fill it. Some ways not so good. In a lot of ways, that makes us consumers. Inevitably, we are consumers. And one way we fill it, I think in our context of the dominant way, is a consumptive economy. And this term, I'm specifically talking sort of about the marketplace, capitalism. And there's a couple ways I want to sort of unpack this a little bit. And the first thing I want to talk about is something about a commodity. So would someone mind reading this quotation, please?
A commodity is an object outside of us, a thing that by its properties satisfies human wants of some sort or another.
And dare you say the person who wrote
Karl Marx.
Well, what's no matter what you think of Karl Marx, what might this quote mean for us as consumptive people, consumptive Christians? Any thoughts here?
It's
kind of strictly Christian thought, but the idea of it is that in our restlessness and our lack of peace, we want to fill that void or soothe that angst by acquiring stuff, as George Carlin might call it. Just go out and get more stuff as a way of taking the edge off of our anxiety and papering over the hole in our hearts.
I mean, I think the key there, relative to you, it's an object outside of us. It's not in us. It's not really about our restlessness. It's trying to say, okay, there's something outside of us that might help me be less restless. How do I attain that? Well, we have a marketplace that produces these. And like I said, the Holden Bookstore has them. We live in a society where no matter where we go, we can shop in our culture. And of course, now we can shop 24/7 with the internet. And I certainly am not trying to be hypocritical there. So
it does sort of position us as fundamentally dependent creatures, that there are things that outside of us that we need. If it was just me and what I have internal to myself, that wouldn't work.
So maybe one way to keep this thread as we go along is that if we are dependent as a creature, what are we dependent on?
Uh-huh.
And how do we live out that dependence? Which
is Marx make a distinction between wants and needs?
Not that I know of, especially not in the way I think you're suggesting, is that there's sort of bodily necessities.
Right,
that
there would be needs that are outside of us that. I don't know the translation.
Yeah,
I know. You know, building on what Chris said, since we are not all self-sufficient, what that does is it puts us immediately into relationship.
Uh-huh.
Different kinds of relationships, different motivations.
That's a great segue to the next quote.
Mm-hmm.
Do you mind reading it? Because part of it is about a relationship. He clearly is saying, here's the relationship between your wants and an object that you are using to satisfy. And I'm going to maybe say human restlessness here. But would you mind reading that quote?
Commodities appear on the scene as if descended from heaven, cloaked in an aura of self-evident value, saying nothing about how, where, or by whom they were produced. We nourish ourselves on food from nowhere and dress in clothes made by no one.
Part of the reality of our commodity economy is that for the most part, I don't know where my chacos come from. And as my wife will tell you, I can tell you where I bought them. And I can also tell you that I bought them on sale. I don't know where the fibers for these pair of shorts came from. For the most part, what I care about is that it clothes my body, and this has insect repellent, so I thought that was a good buy for Holden. It's also, it's got the leggings, so if I want to wear pants, it has a very kind of utilitarian factor. But I didn't say, okay, where's it come? Who made it? Where did the fibers come from? Were the fibers produced in a way that's in accordance with my values? I mean, for the most part, because of the massive amount of consumption that we do, we don't ask those kinds of questions very deeply. And I think this room may be a little different than sort of, your normal American consumer, whatever that may be. I think the fact that you're here, I think, means that you're probably asking these kinds of questions. But the reality is imagine the amount of work it would take to sort of ask questions about where everything that you buy comes from, or to say, okay, guess what, I'm just going to make it all.
Yeah.
I'm going to make my footwear, I'm going to make my shorts, I'm going to make my shirts. I mean, we've sort of given that up. I can't be a good dad, I can't go to work, I can't read any books, since I'm too busy reading, or I'm too busy weaving linens for my clothes.
And then I never go out of the house with you either.
That's true.
But that begs the question of whether or not making sure that it's fair trade textile that's produced from a sustainable sustainable whatever, if all of that is just sort of window dressing to make us sort of feel better about the fact that we continue to be consumers, and we're continuing to consume, we're just consuming in a slightly more ethically friendly way to ourselves, which is still just papering over the hole in our heart.
Uh-huh.
It's soothing the anxiety that we have about continuing to be consumptive creatures, which Christian and many religious traditions would say is really a sign that we are not with God, we are not at peace, we are not in balance. And so does it really matter where the five wishing shorts came from? You know, granted, nobody, well, maybe somebody would love to see you presenting a loincloth, but getting past the
job.
Getting past the, like, the pure absolute necessities is part of our ethical window dressing, just another way that we're sort of easing our angst around continuing to be consumptive.
Who was it who did that?
Who was it who did what?
Just what you're talking about.
The loincloth?
Made all the fibers. So to break the relationship with someone because of the relationship with others.
Gandhi.
Yep.
It seems like one place where you actually can, where you do sort of have to consume, is buying food. This is kind of a little aside, but there was a little booklet once, it was posted quite a while ago, and it was just called Add Justice to Your Shopping List. And it was about grocery shopping. I think the other stuff gets, like you're talking about, gets really, really complicated and hard. But at least it seems like food is one place where you can, you know, we're taught to shop for thrift and value and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And this little book was just saying, add justice to your shopping list. And so it just seems like that's maybe one place where we actually can do something that feels decent.
I'm going to move on. These are all good questions, and I want to make sure that as a part of this consumptive economy, we sort of live in a context that's shaped by the corporate brand. I'm sure you've seen this one before. I'm sure you've seen this one before. I'm sure you've seen one at the top before. And brands are, a couple ways I want to get into this is one, that they're intentionally manipulated. There are people who make brands for a reason. And the reason, ultimately, is to represent or give an ethos or some type of aura around a product or a service, as McDonald's may be. As a part of corporate branding, there is the world of the advertisement, which there's some ridiculous number of ads that the average American teenager sees every day if they watch more than 2 hours of television. Something like 30 minutes of ads for every 2 hours of television. And I think for many of us, we sort of forget that, how many ads that we see. And
not just teenagers, but anyone who watches TV for 2 hours, you see that many ads.
It depends on what you watch.
Yeah, well, anyone who surfs the internet, you've got banner ads and click-throughs at 10 times a day, so in 30 seconds.
And then also the shirt Chris has on, and your shirt partners with Youth Champion.
What's
Detroit Tigers.
Name?
What?
Everything we sell in the bookstore.
I mean, the definition of advertisement is not just sort of on television. I think we're surrounded by it. I'm sure most of you have seen this where people now are getting tattoos put on their forehead. I think it was like a casino in Las Vegas was paying someone to put a tattoo of the brand of the casino on their forehead.
The casino is paying them to do that?
Mm-hmm. Like $30,000.
You can wrap your car.
Yeah, and you can wrap your car. I know that's true. Yeah, I mean, it's. I think for many of us, we don't realize how many ads we're exposed to each and every day. And I want to get into it this way. With the idea that in some ways, corporate branding sort of models our world. And we have to make sense of that, obviously, but I want to do that by reading this kind of long quote that we will try to make sense of together. So who would like to read this lovely quote? Anyone?
Since asceticism undertook to remodel the world and to work out its ideals in the world, material goods have gained an increasing and finally inexorable power over the lives of men. Has it no the previous?
Precious.
No precious period in history? Today, the spirit of religious asceticism has escaped from the Iron Age.
And this is from a book by Max Weber, Protestant. Present ethic and the spirit of capitalism. Anyone read this?
Yeah.
It's a very sort of typical social studies text by a German who sort of was raised Protestant but sort of moved beyond his religious roots. And what he really did is he tried to make sense of capitalism and the commodification of the economy by looking at a religious impulse in both manufacturers and consumers. And so what he did is he took, among other things, asceticism. Ever know what asceticism is? Anyone? What?
I thought it was living really bare.
Yes, it is living really bare. But how do you live really bare? Yes.
You know, go live off the land.
Live off the land. Okay. How you live really bare is you make up a complete system of ideas and rules that orders your every existence. Shall I say that another way?
Yes.
What ascetics have to do, according to Weber, is because they have this end goal, they have this impulse inside of them, where they want to completely diminish and reduce every material element of their person such that they can have some type of mystical experience or some type of unification with the divine. Is that they come up with a way to understand the world outside of them and find rules and boundaries and separation zones from them in the world, which requires them to order every aspect of their existence from pooping, to eating, to the clothes they wear, to the type of housing they have, to the type of entertainment that they participate in.
The rules seem better.
It's even more restrictive than the rules seem better.
Yes, I mean, it's like you get the traps.
So you get this complete ordering of everything you do, from the morning to the evening. In some ways, a place like Holden does it.
Or a prison.
Or a prison, yes. That's a great example.
What about like an Amish, the way that the Amish do life?
Say more about that.
They live simply, but they're not in complete denial of pleasure through denial of choice. Like, to me, the slope is avoid pleasure, avoid temptation, choice begets temptation, no choice. Rigid structure, therefore no choice, no temptation, no succumbing to carnal desires. But the Amish live simply, but they still engage in pleasure-seeking behavior. They don't deny all pleasure, and they don't live a choiceless life. They live simply. What?
As far as I know,
about the carnal part.
Yeah. I think we might debate whether they live a pleasurable life. I mean, for the Amish, the heart of the Amish is that anything that expresses something other than Adam's fall, Adam and Eve's fall, in which life has to be hard, is prideful. So you could say here that the ascetic, or the Amish, it's not really an ascetic vocation, it's the vocation to avoid any attempt at human pride. And human pride would be to use this computer. Because God, through the original sin, has made man and woman responsible for their behaviors on earth. What do men have to do? They have to till the field. And women have to experience the pain of childbirth. And anything that detracts that from that hardship is a sign of human pride and elevates man too high in their relationship to God. So you could say that they also do a total order of life. It's more than maybe just this ascetic. But Weber's point is that ultimately what happens is that asceticism sort of either peters out in some instances, or the rise of the corporate economy starts to make goods available cheaply and efficiently for humans. 1800s, steam power, you can now buy a wagon. Before you'd have to make it, now you can buy a wagon. Then all of a sudden, that impulse of this sort of perfectionism, this vocation of being completely denying the world, or in the Amish sense, denying human pride, takes on a different word. It becomes capitalism. In which capitalism, if you make sense of what capitalism is, it orders everything to what? At sort of at its base level. Profit. So it's not denying the world to be with God, it's using the world to make wealth, to be profitable. So Weber's point here is that ultimately there's religious roots to some of the commodity capitalism that we experience today. So his point here too, today the spirit of religious asceticism has escaped from the iron cage. And this is sort of one of Weber's most famous quotes from this work. His point here is that for many of us, there's nothing we can do about it. We feel powerless in the face of this world. That's been shaped such that we don't feel like we have a choice. I don't really feel like I do have a choice to make my own clothes. I don't really feel like I do have a choice to imagine the world a world a different way. Because this material goods with this kind of quasi-religious impulse underneath it has modeled a world that is normal for us. We've accepted it. I mean, you think about our country, that Karl Marx is a bad word. No matter what you think of Karl Marx and his sort of political economy, it's a bad word. I mean, even the Occupy movement, are they drastically trying to change things? I'm not talking about the end of private property. For most of us, it's a given. Just the way things are. So what do? We make better choices, but we can't change the system. Jeremy?
Well, I was going to say, you know, some of the postmodern theorists would say that we're even one more step removed from the actual product, where it's not even about the product anymore as much as it is about the sign, right? Or the intentionally manipulated sign is what we pay for, more than the product, so we're even that much further removed from the actual object.
Nice segue, thank you.
Thank you all.
Follow me quite tremendously. Brands are designed to move us. They're designed to connect with that restlessness in our heart. And I'm going to focus on two sort of levels that moves us. One is the level of our desire. I want that. And I'll be honest that sometimes I come up to Holden and I see people with cool, fancy hiking boots, and I go, man, my hiking boots, you know, they're okay. They don't quite have that super duper super ball cushion that new soles have. Well, actually, now it's those shoes that look like frog feet.
Yeah.
Hey. Oh. Why don't I have a pair of those? Desire in me is not quenched. All of a sudden I see something and next thing I know I want it. It's something that interests me. It's something that appeals to me. I want that. And I think for me too, part of my own sort of baggage with branding comes from sixth grade. I was sixth grader in Brentwood Middle School in Greeley, Colorado. And my dad was a music ed professor. He made like $17,000 a year. And he had there were four of us, not four kids, but a total of four of us. And everyone, or at least in my sixth grade mind, everyone at Brentwood wore Levi's jeans. The only place you could get Levi's was at the nice, shiny new mall outside of town. I wore either Wrangler, what you got at the JCPenney downtown, or Rustler, which you got at the Big R, which was outside of town next to the feed lot. So I wanted that. That was my desire. Because, well, gee, I wanted to be like everybody else. And in a lot of ways, to me, this connects with the idea of the imagination. I'm lately have become really fascinated with the idea of imagination. Partially because I think a lot of us live sort of through images. And what does the imagination do? It creates an image of what I am and what I want to be. And what do good ads do? They connect imagination with desire. I always think of like a Jeep ad. Here's a Jeep going over the mountain, you know, and then someone gets out and stands on top of the mountain and kind of looks around. What does an ad like that really do? It's saying, look, you can be this if you have that. You can be a mountain man or a mountain woman. You can go off-roading, even though it's something like...
It commodifies the mountain.
Well, that's probably true, too. Yeah. You could take that all the way down if you wanted to. But I think what sort of commodities do is they move us at an imaginative level. We start to see ourselves as a particular type of person. If I wore Levi's, I would be the cool cat at Brentwood Middle School. Which would not have been the case. But, you know, if I had those cool shoes that Sean has, watch out, Holden. I mean, I think there's always this element of self-interest then underneath corporate brands and, frankly, things in this world, that we often connect how we see ourselves and our desires to be something with corporate brands as well as just things. And so I wanted to start with this quote. So how about any volunteers to read this quote?
It is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from regard to their own interest.
This is from Adam Smith, Wealth of Nations. Anyone know when Wealth of Nations was written by the way?
1776.
One of the most influential texts in the Western canon. Wealth of Nations sort of justified the development of the economic system we have. And it's still sort of referred to as the Bible of free market economics. And so what does Adam Smith really say? And a lot of it is, what are we? What kind of creatures are we? Here, according to Adam Smith. What motivates us to act?
Self-interest.
I mean, in some ways, what he's saying, he's answering Augustine's question about restlessness. What really can at least fill part of the whole of our restlessness? Acting for my own success and security. Doing things that benefit me. Because guess what? The butcher's only after their success. The brewer, I would hope the brewer is actually good after good beer. According to Adam Smith, not so much. Baker. This is a fundamental sort of principle that grounds a lot of the contemporary economic context. Yeah, kid.
But don't you think we do, I mean, in terms of that one, it seems like we do a better job, it seems like, in the Lutheran tradition. I respond to that in terms of talking about vocation, in the sense that I think many of us feel like we're trying to do something for the benefit of somebody else, you know, that is worked into our, or how we're raising children or whatever. Whereas the brand, like, I guess to me the branding stuff, it's less apparent how we as like the Lutheran church or the Christian church is responding to that really. But the self-interest one, it seems like we do sort of have a direct response to his wealth, that Wealth of Nations quote, and it would be some of our stuff about vocation. I don't know if that makes sense. But.
Sure.
I mean, on the other hand, isn't self-interest a pretty good definition of sin? So, I mean, there's this sense in which, I mean, that's sort of a contradiction for me, anyway, sort of, you know, living in an economy that says it's all about your self-interest, that's the way to succeed, that's the way to survive and thrive. And, you know, what is sin? Looking out for me, not for you.
And of course, Lutheran tradition has this tension between saint and sinner. And arguably, I think vocation is a good example, but Luther himself, I mean, part of Luther's struggles with God was the fact that he felt he was supposed to do all these penitential acts to help his parents and help other people. And why was he partially doing them?
Self-interest.
And so part of it was he could never get past the fact that, look at me. Look what I'm doing for my family. Look what I'm doing for my relatives to help them with God. Look at me, God. Doing all these great works. That will make me right, right? So I think it's inherent in the tradition. And I think Luther's answer is, you know, that the reality is that this is always a part of us. So we've talked about commodities that are abstract, that we don't know where they come from. We've talked a little bit about branding, how brands work, that I want to be that. I want that. And we've talked about, at least partially, about how brands work. And what I want us to think about is how brands sell us an image of our ideal self. An example here might be the Jeep ad. You know, what is an ideal man? What does he drive? A Jeep. Where does he drive it? Off-road. How does it work? It shows you then what an ideal man is. I always think of truck ads. What does a man look like? Well, he's got a big tool belt, and he gets out and he pulls this big load of cement in his truck, then he goes home, and then he pulls his boat out. And you need a big truck, because if you don't have a big truck, you're not a man. And obviously, I'm using ideal here loosely, because there are many different images. And I think what good brands do is they connect that ideal of who you are with your imagination. There also is this element of desire that wants things to help us to be that self. And so what I'm hoping this works, this kind of came to me the other day, is that we live in this kind of circle day to day. That our consumptive economy gives us images of what we're supposed to be and how beautiful we can look and what kind of car we're supposed to drive and what we're supposed to wear that we then desire. The desire chases after that image, thinking, oh, once I have that, I'll be this. But of course, once I have that, there's something new and improved that pops up, or something more and better.
Yeah, think of cell phones. Right?
Shelf life of yesterday.
Yeah.
That there's this chase. And I think many of us want it to be an upward chase. You know, if I have a better computer, I'll be more productive. If I'm more productive, I'll be a better person. But I think, in some ways, thinking about it through Augustine's lenses, it's always flat. Because things can never do it. We can never catch up with that ideal. We can never catch up with that person that we're actually called to be, either by God or by the corporate world. Because it's always something more.
Better.
Yeah.
I always want to throw in one thing about the corporate world, because I've been there in a few situations. The brand the strategy, and this is no secret or anything, is not only the brand, it's to build the brand. And if you build the brand, that makes the entire corporate entity more desirable to competitors or other people, and therefore makes mergers and acquisitions a big deal, because people pay for the blue sky of the brand. Because the brand in and of itself has this tremendous value because of all of this, you know, consumer stuff you're talking about. And so when the brand is built and is sold, there's greater value for the shareholders in the how much they get for the shares, and of course tremendous more value for management that can, you know, capture all of that profit. So building the brand is another, their idea is an upward circle of
profit,
that
profit,
brand.
Profit.
Yeah, profit and capital.
So here's the circle. How do we end that circle? That's not a very good circle. I know that it's flat. Here's us. Here's God. God descends in the cross. In the middle of that circle of us racing around and sort of full of imagination and full of desire. This is how we start to find rest as Christians. To recognize that sort of something more to our desires. There's something more to our imagination than just this endless chase. So before I move along a little bit more, I want to ask you to maybe turn to your neighbor, and I want to ask you what consumer brands are part of your life, and what do they say about you?
Thank you.
So is this an easy exercise? Was it easy to come up with brands?
Not really.
Not really. So what does that say?
What it says for me is that I've been consciously reducing over the years.
Say that again, Barbara.
What it says for me is that I've been consciously reducing that idea over the years.
Okay. So you're aware of your choices and behaviors and thinking about those.
Not to the extent that you've described, really, but yes, in some way.
You were going to say something too, or not?
Just that I kind of pick and choose areas where I seem to be a more brand conscious, and then other areas it's like good enough. You know, I just need it to be serviceable and a reasonable quality, and I don't really care what brand it is.
Okay.
But other brands, it's like, oh, I need to be keep up with my peers, for example. I work in IT. So.
Sure.
But, for example, I've made a conscious choice not to buy Apple products.
Oh, interesting.
So, yeah, I see. Because
we're all
snobs. I see your Mac.
Yeah. This was used,
right? But
can I say why don't you buy an Apple product?
To me, it always just felt too much like a brand.
Hmm.
Like a cult.
No, I was just going to say.
Yeah.
Well, that's what Apple wants you to say. They want you to say it's a quality product.
I have an Android phone, and I'm perfectly happy with a cool Android phone. You know, but am I out there getting the new one that comes out like every other month? No.
Okay. Mary, let me think.
Yeah, two things we talked about were how, as young women, sometimes we feel that the brand, not necessarily the brands, but sort of the type of clothes, which would be any number of brands, there's sort of pressure as you're sort of establishing yourself in a profession, sort of present yourself in a way to be taken seriously, that you know, we're competent, we're of age for this job, but we're women and we're not girls. And there's some sort of, I feel sort of icky about it, but I purchased new clothes when I went into a PhD program because I felt like I need to feel in myself and before other people, this is my profession now.
What's the brand name? Cool suit.
Oh, I don't own a suit yet. For me, the Ann Taylor Loft.
Yeah.
Sort of like,
yeah.
I can sort of, on my budget, put it together, pull myself together.
I know that.
And that's important to me, because I feel otherwise it reflects on who I am, and also this imagination of myself that I want to become this, you know, spiffy woman professor, you know.
serious,
image there. Right, yeah, and take it seriously. And the other thing we talked about was how even in some ways the choices we make not to consume, so we were talking about how sometimes we buy things at Goodwill, so it is a consumer choice, but it's a choice for recycling things.
Yeah.
That even, for me at least, there's even some identity wrapped up in that.
Yes.
Oh,
absolutely.
I am one who,
absolutely.
You know, I don't buy everything new. I mean,
right.
Have you seen how old these shoes are? Like,
right.
I'm a little proud of it because
right.
It says something about this imagination I have of who I am and who I strive to be. So
that's great.
Yeah.
I think people who shop at Goodwill share more about where they bought their. And I probably include myself in that. But every time I do it, I'm like,
really?
Because there's that little pride, because at least inside my head, I'm doing this like cycle of identity and consumerism. And anyway.
Yeah.
So I have this question, which is, it's about all this stuff about, like, the choices, like the goodwill stuff, because I can shop at goodwill. But, you know, like, and we were talking about having a Prius, like, yeah, this is a Prius, and I think it sounds to me in some ways like in this conversation we're saying all choices have some negative element to them, and yet I don't necessarily agree with that. I think that, and I don't know if that's even what's being said,
okay. But
it feels like some choices are made for very good reasons, like buying a Prius is, you know, for that example, or shopping at Google, like, to help, you know, reduce the carbon footprint,
sure.
Or just to help with global warming. Like, so when,
of course, there are
point,
a number of studies, and this is a big debate about electric cars,
mm-hmm.
that say that buying a Hummer is actually less of a carbon footprint than buying an electric car right now.
Right. I mean, so we, when we talked about that.
Because the amount, because part of it is this abstract commodification thing, that we don't think about the fact that where the chemicals and the things that go into the batteries come from, and when the batteries run out after certain, where they go, and the mining of these, I know some of the chemicals in the batteries are mined from extremely dangerous and sort of, let's say, totalitarian regimes of the world. That there's all these, you're right. I do think that there's no perfect choice.
Right. I mean, like, Jim said that he had learned after they bought the Prius that you know, even if every single American who owns a car owned a Prius, it wouldn't even make a dent in global warming. Mm-hmm. So, but the intention,
sure.
My point is about the intention. So, and I hear what you're saying, that if we knew truly the origins and all the details about all of our choices about consumerism, then we might make different choices. But anyway.
But the question might be, should any of us be driving cars, period?
Exactly. Well, that's a good
so.
But then it would just be which bicycle you have.
Right.
Right.
Bicycle
at
Goodwill.
Yeah. Yeah. Where the carbon fibers came from.
There have been.
I'm sorry.
I'd like to follow up on Chris's point, though, because I think there are some good choices you can make. We were talking about food. And of course, we shop at our food co-op, right?
Right.
Because they provide good food. But even within that, we know that Rensdue Farm provides the best carrots. So when we go to the farmer's market and we see Rensdue Farm, we know that we're going to pick them because they have quality carrots. Is that, can you see a negative to that?
I think it's important to, I just think it's important to question our need for choices. That's, you know, yeah, there are good choices, but I always just, and I think the advertising industry has caught on to that, so a lot of things are advertised to look all natural, and even though they're not, right?
Yeah.
But they've caught on to our desire for that,
so
they've made their brand, their branding and labeling look like it's...
Sure.
So
McDonald's now sells something in brown bags, so
it's white bags.
Sure,
right.
But it also, there's also something too, I think, about, like, you can get, because we are in this system already, it seems like,
mm-hmm.
that you can get, and I thought about this as I entered the world of motherhood, right, where there's this huge debate about, like, disposable diapers versus cloth diapers, and actually, and, like, you know, some of my friends were making all of their baby food, and they're like, grinder, and some of them were researching every possible mattress you could ever own to make sure that the stuff inside the mattress would not like light the baby on fire, and what carpeting did you have in your room, like, because maybe that's going to kill the baby, and like everything came about, everything. So like in a renewed way, like, what are all the choices you're going to make about this new child? And it got so exhausting that. There's also something to be said for if you start obsessing about all these choices constantly, which you can, right? Like if you decide you're going to be this good consumer, that and you're on consumer reports, that then what? Then like suddenly you're not going to church because you read like all of this other stuff, or like you don't have a marriage anymore because you were researching like
my husband just wants to do grass-fed beef, and I've spent all this time finding all the restaurants within a 30-minute radius that serve only grass-fed beef, because he really wants it, you know.
Local, just local. One.
It's
just
local.
One.
Yeah,
sure,
actually,
it is
one. Right, which was a big effort. I mean, I'm not criticizing that choice,
no,
it was a good one, but I just, like, I mean, I don't know, like, it makes me feel more anxious and neurotic
sure.
to start trying to make the right choices.
Yeah. Well, maybe I'll... I mean, that's. I think that's. I mean, part of it. This gets us back, I think, to Christ, God, descending to the circle of both anxiety but imaginative desire. And I'm using John here because Mary Emily's using John for the Bible study. Well, she's not quite going where I'm going. But one thing I want to say is that part of Brand's is this. Sense that we need those things to be abundant, to live well. And I think we as Christians have a different sense of what abundance is. A different place where that restlessness tries to reside. A different sort of focal point, if you want, of our desires and imagination. That and really says, okay, a new iPhone really isn't going to matter that much for my life relative to a phone or some means of communication. I mean, how many of you come up here and miss your phone?
I get it out and edit. Just
how many people's cell phones are here as alarm clocks?
Yeah.
My clock doesn't work, otherwise
it
would be.
Though, because
yeah.
you have to get, as an alarm clock, because it has to be able to get the time. Please.
Yeah, that's, I actually wish my cell phone worked because we don't have
yeah.
time.
Like,
but,
I needed to buy an alarm clock to come, you know, a travel alarm, and Eric said, why don't you just use your cell phone? It's like, my cell phone doesn't work at home.
Yeah.
I mean, it won't even get
right,
the
yeah.
time, but so, yeah. So, yeah.
I mean, part of it is stepping outside of that world, outside of a place like Holden, where we're sort of almost trained daily to think about wants and needs and desires and what we want to be. That we don't really, oh, my friend has, oh, maybe, like for me lately, it's been an iPad. Because they look cool. And...
You can borrow one later on this show.
But I'm debating, will I be more productive? Will I be a better scholar? Will I be a better husband and father? Probably not.
But I'll think you are.
Oh, yes. So part of it is a very different definition, a very different starting point. It's not the things and the stuff in the world that's going to satisfy that restlessness. And I think as a sort of a consequence, you also get the recognition that when we think about what it really means to be, sort of an ideal image of who we are, it's relational. It's not in relationship to our things. It's in relationship to God and others. That's sort of fundamental. And I think at a practical level, when we think about choices, it demands that we ask questions about the other people who made these things and where they came from. Because we are in relationship with those in China, for instance. We are in relationship to those who sell this and make the fabrics. I mean, our neighbors are there too. And so I do think it does raise questions about, you know, we need to care for what we care for. Because you're called by God to abide in God. And God's love. And at a practical level, I think that gets back to your point about being intentional, I think. And the reality is, and especially for those who come out of the Lutheran tradition, there's no end to this cycle. Even if Christ, I mean, it's a daily cycle of our desires for things and success and to end the restlessness, which we're not going to end it. And in some ways, for us, as for most of us, I'm assuming that are Lutherans, that actually is freeing. Because it will never end. We will never find rest. It's a daily sort of practice to acknowledge that, to be intentional. care about our desires, to care about where our imagination goes, to care about what we purchase and consume. Because ultimately, this is what God calls us. This is how God made us. And I think with that, I'll end here. Any other quick questions, or it's about 7:15, so.
Go ahead. I was just going to put you back into the iron cage here for a minute.
Yeah.
Okay, the one specific you said here is that we should ask where the fibers came from.
Yeah.
When do you find out that the fibers came from a sweatshop in China? What's your next step?
Well, hopefully you're doing this before you make the purchase.
Okay, well, say you start doing it when you go down the lake this time.
Well, I mean, I think the reality is in our world there are really poor choices and much better choices. And I think for most of us who need a car, a Prius is a better choice overall, long term, than a Hummer. No matter what this debate about the environmental impact because of its overall. And I think the hope is ultimately that we'll get to a point, and I don't know how hopeful we should really be about this, but ultimately that we recognize the wider relationality of the things we consume as we make a purchase of them. And I know there are some stores who, like even Walmart apparently now, is starting to label the environmental impact of certain products on their shelves. As much as I'm not a big fan of Walmart, but I mean, we're gonna consume, we have needs. And I think ultimately, it isn't a matter of saying we have to stop. We're not going to be monks. I don't think that's the model here, especially in the Lutheran tradition. I mean, what instead I think it recognizes that we just need to care for what we choose, or care for what we care about, and how we make those choices. And there are better choices, but it obligates us to make those. It's more than just about carrots. I mean, clearly you've done some research. You've paid attention to where these carrots come from. You've also paid attention to the fact that they're good.
I'm not sure I have the same choice. I could choose China or Indonesia or Dominican Republic or Guatemala, El Salvador.
Sure.
Sweatshop do I choose?
That's my point. You are still operating in the iron cage that Weber says we can't get out of. And so even though we have, you know, an idea of what life abundant is supposed to be, we are just constrained in this monster. And, you know, sentenced, at least for the time of our life, and you're a pessimist, I know you agree with this, to be stuck right there in that same iron cage. Because when you go down lake, you know, you're going to drive, and you're going to consume, and you're going to do... I mean, to belong to the community of St. Martin, for me, which is a wonderful alternative community, requires me to drive about 2.5 times per week over the Seward neighborhood. What's the trade-off? It's probably a failure for me, because I'm in the iron cage.
Yeah, this just popped into my head. Like, you know how, like, Native Americans, like, when they would, like, kill or fall, you know, they sort of thank it for giving its life. I just wonder if, you know, just as a exercise in consciousness, as we get dressed, to look at our labels and say thank you, to look at that Sri Lankan and think of a Sri Lankan maybe child who's made this shirt for us, and just to say thank you for this shirt.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't want us to be late for Vespers. I think that would be a bad precedent. Thank you. I appreciate the conversation.